We've talked a lot in our study of the book of Revelation about these interludes, these passages that kind of come between the main action in the book of the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. And chapters 12 to 14 are one of the great interludes really in the book of Revelation that fill in a lot of details for us about key people, key events, key players during this final end time drama that's set forth for us in the book of Revelation. Really the last chapter here that forms this great interlude where we have so much information is Revelation chapter 14. Because what you have in chapter 15 then is we go back to heaven again. We have a prelude then and a heavenly scene before the bowl judgments, these final judgments are unleashed on the earth. So chapter 14 is really the final chapter before we really get to the last details of this current age, the bowl judgments and the campaign of Armageddon and these things. So chapter 14, when we come to this chapter, begins with the words, and I looked. It's interesting, 10 times you find this in the book of Revelation. It starts back in chapter 4 and verse 1 there, and I looked, and he's seeing these things. So it introduces another key event in the book. And I call chapter 14 in the book of Revelation, I call it the preview of coming attractions. What we've said as we've gone through these chapters that are kind of the interludes or these intermissions or these fill-ins is that generally what they do is they go back and fill in some details of what was happening while these events were while these seals and trumpets were being unleashed on the earth. For instance, back in chapter 7, that interlude there is giving us some of the events that are happening while the seals are being opened. And then in chapters 10 and 11, we have the fill-in information there that gives us some of the information of what is happening while those trumpets are being blown. And so they're filling in, kind of going back and filling in detail. In chapter 14, the interlude or intermission here, I see a little differently. This interlude is actually giving us a preview or a look ahead of summarizing some things that are coming. So it's kind of a quick way of just giving us a snapshot of here's some things that are going to happen and giving us kind of a foreshadow or a preview of those things. So this is kind of what I call an overview or a panorama or a preview of the rest of the book. So this chapter is kind of proleptic. It's looking to the future. And what we have in this chapter are seven what I would call vignettes or visions or snapshots of the major events at the end of the tribulation. So it's kind of like you're there at a movie, and before you see the movie, they show you two or three previews or snapshots of coming features. That's what we have here. And there's seven of them. And we'll look at each of these and just summarize them quickly together. But again, this interlude here runs ahead to kind of tell us some things that are coming. So we'll look at each one of these snapshots here as we go along through the passage. Notice in chapter 14, verse 1, we have the first one of these. I looked and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. Heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters, like the sound of a loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures. And notice it says, and no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who'd been purchased from the earth. So they've been redeemed. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women. So again, I take it this 144,000 are males and they've kept themselves pure. For they are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And they have been purchased from among men as the first fruits to God and the Lamb. And no lie was found in their mouth. And the no lie there probably is the lie of the Antichrist. Really, it's the lie wasn't found in their mouth. They're blameless. Now, this is an amazing scene here. It's a contrast with what we just had in chapter 13. Chapter 13, you had the beast. Now you have the Lamb. You have Satan standing on the sand of the seashore in chapter 13. You have the Lamb on Mount Zion. In chapter 13, you had the followers of the beast. Now you have the followers of the Lamb. In chapter 13, the beast is victorious. Here now the Lamb is victorious. This is a picture here of Jesus Christ after he has returned, and it's a millennial scene. It's a scene now of this 144,000 entering the millennial reign of Christ. Now, we think to ourselves, why would you put an earthly millennial scene here, this deliverance of the 144,000? Well, it's an earthly scene, I believe, because it mentions here Mount Zion, which is in the land of Israel. It's a part of the city of Jerusalem. And notice he says, I heard a voice from heaven. So if you hear a voice from heaven, it probably means you're on the earth. So this is an earthly scene after the Lamb has returned and this 144,000 is ready to go into the millennium. So it's a foreview of the millennial reign. Now again, why put a millennial scene here? Well, the reason you put a millennial scene here, I think, is to show God's faithfulness. You just had this chapter about the beast and the false prophet and all the destruction they will bring. It's telling us here that God has preserved the 144,000 all the way through the tribulation, and now they're ready to enter the millennial kingdom. Notice when you get here to Revelation chapter 14, it doesn't say, and I saw 143,999. Not one of them is missing. It's all 144,000 of them. God has preserved them. He's purchased them. He's protected them through this time. So it's a great scene here of victory. It's a preview of the victory that's coming. So lest you read chapter 13 about the beast and the false prophet and get discouraged, it's all over. God says, let me just go ahead and give you a little preview here. The Lamb's going to be victorious. The 144,000 are going to make it through. Christ is going to rule and reign in His messianic kingdom. Beautiful, victorious picture. So all of Satan's attempts, by the way, as well, to destroy the Jews have failed. That tells us that as well, doesn't it? Satan's tried to wipe out the Jews during the tribulation. You got these 144,000 Jews alive there at the end. So all of Satan's efforts to destroy the Jewish people have been thwarted. Now the next scene here is what I call the declaration of the gospel. This is one of the most interesting things in the whole book of Revelation. I'm not sure that I even fully understand it. I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And you say, well, what is this eternal gospel? Well, the next verse tells us. He said with a loud voice, fear God and give Him glory, because the hour of His judgment has come. And worship Him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of water. Now, what he sees here is a vision here of these angels. And he sees a vision of three angels here, verses 6 and 7. Verse 8, there's another angel. And in verse 9, there's another angel introduced there. But the first angel here says that, the first angel here is flying in the mid-heaven, and he has an eternal gospel, and he's crying out with a loud voice. So if we take this literally here, at some point during the tribulation, an angel is going to fly in the mid-heaven and he's going to cry out that everybody in the world can hear him, and he's going to proclaim the eternal gospel. Fear God and give Him glory, because the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of water. Now, you say, well, why is this here? Well, I think one of the reasons, again, is to show the Antichrist cannot prevent the preaching of God's Word. No matter what he does, God can send an angel in the sky to preach it if He wants to. So Satan cannot thwart the preaching of the Word of God. And that should be an encouragement to us in our world today. This mention here of the eternal gospel in verse 6, that is the only time the word gospel appears in the book of Revelation. Not a lot of gospel in the book of Revelation, but it is here in this passage. And so what this may be is a final call for repentance for the world. Now you hear this and you say, well, how's this the gospel, to fear God and give Him glory? Well, in one sense, the eternal gospel really is this. It's a living faith in the living God. Throughout all of history, that's the gospel. We have a living faith in the living God. When you go on down, though, just a few verses later to verse 12, I want to point something out. It says, here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandment of God and their faith in Jesus. So faith in Jesus is mentioned here. Think about this. If you have faith in Jesus, then it's evidence you do fear God. You believe that He is the Creator. But the issue here, again, is the gospel's going forth. this gospel that's usually given to men. You think about the gospel is normally preached by people, but here it's an angel who's declaring this eternal gospel to those who live on the earth during this coming time of tribulation. So another little vignette here of the declaration, the preaching of this gospel message to all the nations of the earth in the end time. The third of these vignettes is the destruction of Babylon in chapter 14, verse 8. Another angel, a second one, followed saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." Chapters 17 and 18 of the book of Revelation are all about the destruction of Babylon. So again, this is another preview. He's just saying here, as if it's already happened, Babylon has fallen. Babylon's going to be destroyed. God is going to take care of Babylon. So it's a preview of what we're going to see in chapters 17 and 18 that deal with the destruction of the city of Babylon. So another one of these little cameos or little snapshots here. Now, verses 9 to 11 is the fourth of these little previews for us, and I call this the doom of the defectors. It says, "Another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with the fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image and whoever receives the mark of his name.'" Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandment of God and their faith in Jesus. Now this third angel announces judgment on those who worship the beast. So again, this is a preview. It's looking ahead. Those who worship the beast are going to be doomed. This is a very graphic picture here of God's judgment. And I think it's telling us that people during the tribulation who take the mark of the beast are going to be doomed. Now, there are some Bible teachers today who are saying that even people who take the mark of the beast will still have an opportunity to be saved. And again, they give good reasons for that. It's possible. But this seems to be a passage to me that says, if you worship the beast and his image and receive his mark, you're going to drink of the wine of the fierce wrath of God. In other words, this is going to be a time in history when people are going to face a clear-cut choice. It's going to be Christ, or it's going to be Antichrist. And if they make the choice to follow the lie and the delusion that Antichrist is God and worship him, that's going to seal their fate. I think that's what this is saying. But notice how graphic it is. It says that they're going to receive undiluted wrath with torment before God and the angels forever without any rest. The smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And you really can't speak of eternity any more clearly than with the words that are used here in this passage. And they have no rest day and night. This does away with the idea of annihilationism, doesn't it? That they're going to cease to exist. Because what some will say is it's not that the punishment goes on forever, but it's the smoke and the fires of hell that are never extinguished. And those who believe in annihilationism hold that view. They'll say, look, that the punishing goes on forever and ever, if you will, but not the punishment per se. So they'll say it's the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, but they're not going to be there during that period of time. They will have been annihilated. But it says right after that, they have no rest day and night. So to me, I think this speaks of the fact that they're conscious as this is taking place, as you worship the beast. I have to say this. I mean, to me, the idea of hell is not the most disturbing doctrine. It is a very disturbing doctrine, really, in some ways for us, because we're finite creatures. We can't get our mind around it. But the fact that there is a hell and a place of punishment for those who reject God and those who rebel against Him, that doesn't bother me. The aspect of hell that is the disturbing doctrine to me in all the Bible is the duration of it. It's the duration of hell. It's not that there's a hell that bothers me. It's the duration of it. And as finite creatures as we are, that is a difficult thing for us to get our minds around. Why will there be a hell that lasts for all eternity, that those who reject God we'll spend forever. And that is a difficult thing. And I anguish over that sometimes in my life. And I've often told people, if there's one thing that I could get to heaven and be wrong about, that would be it. If I were wrong about that, that's the one thing I will be happy to be wrong about. And those who hold to annihilationism or some type of conditional immortality or something like that, if they're right, I will be glad. But I don't think that's what the Bible teaches. But to me, if words have meaning, these words here tell us that these beast worshipers will be tormented forever and ever. They're going to have no rest day or night. That's what the text tells us. And I think you could say, well, that's just for these people. Well, but other places in the Bible apply it to others who are lost as well. And these same words, forever and ever, are used of the existence of God, and they're used of our time in heaven with the Lord. So this is a sobering passage here. It's the doom of the defectors. Then he goes to the next thing, known it's a positive. Look at verse 12 and 13. Here's the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So look, the defectors are going to be doomed who worship Antichrist. But this is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandment of God and faith in Jesus. Heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. It's another one of these beatitudes in the book of Revelation. Yes, says the Spirit, they may rest from their labors, for their deeds will follow after them. Now, we often hear people quote this at a funeral, you know, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. And certainly you can make an application, but this is a passage that's speaking of people during the tribulation. They keep the commandment of God. Their faith is in Jesus. They're blessed who die in the Lord from now on. Their deeds will follow after them. They're going to go and be with the Lord, in distinction to these beast worshipers who suffer His wrath and torment forever and ever. So loyalty to Christ under the reign of the beast will mean death for many people. But they're going to go on and their deeds will follow after them and they'll receive their reward. The sixth and really the seventh one of these little previews here is a preview of Armageddon. They're different, and the verses 14 to 16 is often called the day of harvest because it pictures harvesting grain, and then 17 to 20 pictures harvesting grapes. So they're two different pictures, but I think they could be two different pictures of the same thing. It's the judgment at the end of the age. Now, some will say that verses 14 through 16 here is kind of the just the general judgment through that period of time, whereas 17 to 20 is the ultimate final judgment. But I just take them as two different perspectives of the final judgment. Let me read these verses for us. It says, I looked and behold a white cloud, and sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man. So it's Jesus. Got a golden crown on his head, a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple. Again, notice, remember, in heaven there's a temple. You're all seeing these angels coming out of this temple. That's where God's throne is in heaven. And he says, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. And it says, and another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. And another angel, the one who had the power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. And it's a different Greek word that's used here. I mean, they're bursting with juice. They're just fully ripe here. The earth is ripe to be reaped. And the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city. And blood came out from the winepress up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. So this looks ahead to the final judgment. Now, we haven't gotten there yet in the book, because the final judgment is not going to be until chapter 19 when Jesus returns and defeats the enemies there. But again, this is a look at this, a foreshadowing of this, or a preview of what's coming. And I take these verses here to be a preview or a foreshadowing of Armageddon, what's commonly called the campaign of Armageddon. Now, we won't get to Armageddon till we get to chapter 16 and chapter 19. But this is a preview here of it. Because it says here that God is going to reap the earth, that Christ is going to reap the earth, and these nations and the peoples are like grapes that are going to be thrown into a big wine vat. And it's the wine vat of the wrath of God, and it was trodden outside the city, which of course would be the city of Jerusalem, which is where the campaign of Armageddon is going to take place outside the city in the land of Israel. And blood came out from the winepress up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. So the figure that's given here, 200 miles in the New American Standard, some would take that distance and make it more like about 180 miles. But it's basically the distance from Armageddon in the north all the way down to Basra or Edom down in the south. It's with a little bit extra to spare. So in other words, this campaign of Armageddon is going to span the entire land of Israel. We'll talk about that more when we get to chapter 16. But here's the image. Back in that day, you'd take a big cluster of grapes and you'd throw it into a big vat, and it's a big stone vat, and there's a little spout on the side, and you would get in there and stomp the grapes. You'd squish these grapes, and the juice would come out of the grapes in this big, large vat, or this big wine press, and would go over and drain down into this vat, and that's how you got the grape juice. So it pictures Jesus taking these grapes, which pictures the nations of the earth, throwing them into a big wine press, and going in and stomping on them, and the juice that comes out, rather than being the juice from a grape, is blood. And it flows up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. So this is a picture of devastating judgment that comes on the earth. People will often say, now wait a minute though, and I've read a lot of prophecy books on this, and they'll say the blood is going to flow as deep as a horse's bridle, which I guess depending on how tall a horse is, somewhere around 4 or 5 feet for a distance of 200 miles or maybe 180 miles distance. Now I used to read this when I was a little boy, and I'm not very good at math, but I'd sit there and think, now how much blood is in one body and how many bodies would that take? So I don't take this that there's literally going to be blood flowing 4 or 5 feet deep for 200 miles. To me, it goes back here, this does, again, to the image. The image is someone stepping into a wine press, stomping grapes. And that when you stomp the grapes, the juice was squirting up as high as a horse's bridle. In other words, you know, the wine press would be a couple of feet off the ground. That juice is squirting out a foot or two up into the air, up to the horse's bridle. And the picture here is the stomping is going to be severe enough for that to squirt up as high as the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles, is what he's saying here, or about 180 miles. And again, that is the distance from Megiddo up in the north with a little bit to spare down to Basra. Remember we read the passage earlier in Isaiah chapter 63 where it says, who is this man who's coming up from Edom? And ask him, why are your clothes covered in red? He says, for I've been treading the wine press alone, treading the wine press of the fierce wrath of God. So the campaign of Armageddon is going to span all the way from Armageddon in the north all the way down to Basra, to Edom in the south. It's going to span the entire land. And that's why the distance here is given of about 180 up to 200 miles. So this here is a picture for us, a preview of what we're going to see when we get to chapter 16 and to chapter 19 with the second coming of Jesus. So this is kind of the last one now of these little vignettes or these cameos or these snapshots of some events that are going to come in the future. So that's what chapter 14 is about. When you think of Revelation 14, think of the preview of coming attractions. Seven of these little snapshots of things that are going to happen in the future, some of which are going to be elaborated upon further along as we go into the book. Now the book, the chapter here, chapter 14 has ended, and we're to the place now where we're really finished with this interlude. And what we're going to do is we're going to go back to heaven in chapter 15. When the seals, before the seals are opened, there's a scene in heaven. Before the trumpets were blown, there was a scene in heaven. Chapter 16, the bowls are going to be poured out. Before that, we're going to go back to heaven again for another scene. That's chapter 15, the final one of these heavenly scenes before the bowls are unleashed on the earth. So we'll pick up there next time with this beautiful heavenly scene in chapter 15, a great contrast out of what we've just seen in chapter 14.